morning. It's 4 minutes past the hour. This is the Faith Radio Network as we kick off a brand new week together. I pray that you had a good weekend, spent some time relaxing and refreshing with friends or family, and had a good day at church yesterday. Boy, we had a great sermon at my church. I went away very convicted, which I'll tell you about a little later on. Coming up in less than 5 minutes, Rebecca Maxwell, Paul Perreault, and I will update you on some of the big stories from over the weekend and maybe a few that you may have missed. And then later on this hour, political scientist Dr. Adam Carrington will provide some analysis on the presidential race. He'll tell us why many Christians believe it is critical for the Republicans to retain control of the U.S. Senate. Well, the 2016 World Series is set. The Cleveland Indians and the Chicago Cubs, both of those teams, both those franchises, very, very hungry to bring a championship to their cities. If you think about it, Cleveland, they haven't had a World Series winner since 1948. The last time they appeared there, they lost to the Florida Marlins. I think that was around late 90s, 97. The Chicago Cubs haven't even been to a World Series in 71 years. The last time they won, 1908. So those two teams are very, very hungry for a series. And they've taken very difficult and different routes to get to the Fall Classic. The Cubs are what some sportscasters might call a complete dominant club. They have a starting rotation filled with some great stars. Cleveland doesn't possess any big names. In fact, they've had a lot of injuries on their team. Corey Kluber being the ace of the staff there. So the advantage really goes to the Cubs. They got some guys that really just crush the baseball. Cleveland, very athletic. They have some super talented guys, exciting players to watch. So we shall see how this World Series shakes out. 6 minutes past the hour here at the Faith Radio Network. Stick around as we update you on some of the big stories in the news over the weekend. Welcome back. 8 minutes past the hour. It's Faith Radio. I'm Bill Meyer, Rebecca Maxwell, Paul Perreault joining me here in the studio. I know we have a lot of Chicago Cubs fans here at the radio station. Plus, we have a lot of Twins fans because we're based in Minnesota.
Yeah, exactly.
But there are many transplants from Illinois who today are celebrating big time.
Oh, big time. Of course, there's one person here at our headquarters. Okay, it's Dave St. John. He's one of our major people here at the organization. Now, he's from Chicago. He's actually on the opposite side of things. Because
White Sox fan.
He is a White Sox fan, and so it's like, you know, White Sox get no credit for anything, he feels. Everything is Cubs down in Chicago. To me, though, okay, you were talking about the history of the Cubs, and it's actually, I did a little searching. Okay, I guess the Cubs are the oldest team in the Major League Baseball. Wow. They predate Major League Baseball by numerous years. They were founded back in 1870. Here's the crazy thing. You know what their first name was? They weren't originally the Cubs.
No, what were they called?
The White Stockings.
Well, they do wear white stockings. So.
Yes, they've also had other interesting names, including, and I was sharing this with Rebecca here. Among the other names they had through the years, the Colts, the Orphans, the Microbes. Don't let the scientists name the team.
There you go. Never a
life lessons.
There. Yeah, yeah. So, Rebecca, I have some updates on the fans in Chicago.
Ooh, good.
Saturday night, you know, when they won, the police were, they didn't really know what to expect in downtown Chicago. But Chicago police spokesman Anthony, this is a great name, Guglielmi, he says, "It was a very safe and enjoyable celebration." He says officers only made 6 misdemeanor arrests in a crowd of 30,000 people.
That's pretty good.
Crowded into downtown. The arrests were for unlawful sale of World Series tickets, obstructing traffic, disorderly conduct, and other misdemeanors. And the Chicago Cubs fans, of course, all over the country, because so many people grew up in Chicago and then relocated to other places. So I spent several years in Texas, and there's a lot of Cubs fans in Texas, believe it or not. And in San Antonio, Chicago native Jimmy Tingus owns the Wrigleyville Grill, where he caters to homesick former Chicagoans still craving hot dogs and Italian beef. The restaurant owner says his customers love sharing memories of Blizzards, basketball champions, and 2 Mayor Dailies. On Saturday, The Wrigleyville Grill patrons watched the Cubs win Game 6. He said people were going nuts in the restaurant and many shed tears.
I can imagine. I mean, I don't even follow baseball, and I'm rooting for the Cubs just because, I mean, there's just something historic about it. You kind of want to be a part of the moment. Yes. I mean, when the last time they've been in the World Series, the Tsar still ruled Russia. Like, you know, the Ottoman Empire was still a thing. Like, it's been a while.
The Ottoman Empire was still a thing. There you go. And I still can't believe they were called the Microbes at one point.
Let me give you one more, because we have a couple of our regulars here on Faith Radio, Chris Martin, the Millennial Evangelical, big Chicago Cubs fan. He's happy. And then Ed Stetzer, who used to work with him, and now you remember Ed.
In Chicago.
He's now moved to Chicago and this year. And somebody tweeted over the weekend, it's like, see what happens. Ed Stetzer comes to Chicago and the Cubs win the series.
They've been blessed.
Actually, it's kind of funny because I responded back to that tweet saying, well, they used to worry about the curse of the goat. Now it's the blessing of the goatee. If you ever seen Ed, he sports a rather robust goatee.
That's great. Anyway. Well, congratulations to the Cubs.
Yes.
And it will be an interesting series. Now, let's move on to a few other stories that have been in the news this week.
Do we have to? They're not as fun.
No, they're not as fun.
No.
But we have an election. We do have an election coming up in about 2 weeks.
That's true.
So, Rebecca, we're going to talk extensively to Adam Carrington about this after 6:30 this morning. But if you could just give us a little update on the polling numbers. What's interesting is Hillary putting a whole bunch of money into the Senate races.
Yes,
right now.
And that in itself is a pretty sure sign that they are, in fact, sure. And I think on the whole, the Democratic Party tends to invest a lot in their infrastructure, and both parties are considered healthy when they do this, that if the presidential candidate is ahead or if things are going well, then they'll take a lot of the money from that campaign and start putting it into the down ballot races. And that's what the Clinton campaign is doing. It's not surprising considering the latest polls have Hillary Clinton up in the presidential race by double digits. I think the latest ABC poll had her up 12 points over Donald Trump. And there's really not a lot of time to make anything like that up or for there to be many shifts. So the Clinton campaign is actually putting in $1 million, which is a significant amount in smaller states, especially into Indiana and Missouri. And, I mean, she's not going to win in those states, or it's pretty unlikely that she would win there, but it would be enough to boost some of the Democratic candidates in their Senate races, in their House races. In recent days, we've also seen them invest heavily in Pennsylvania, which is a race where Pat Toomey is struggling to hold on to the Republican seat right now, and Democrats hope to turn that seat, as well as putting in a lot of money into some of the blue districts in Texas to try and influence their state House and Senate, and in Arizona, I believe, as well. So lots of money being spread around by the Clinton campaign in order to boost down ballot Democratic races.
Mm. Now, Paul, things are not all roses coming up roses for Mrs. Clinton, because more unfortunate information coming out about some of those emails.
Yeah, over the weekend, starting on Friday and right on through the weekend, the Julian Assange and WikiLeaks were releasing more of these groups of emails, mainly around John Podesta, one of her main advisors. Now, the one that came out on Friday got blocked because of that whole internet outage that happened, and Twitter was really affected. But again, you know, not a lot that really would tie Hillary directly to a lot of the stuff that was talked about, but the fact that it's part of her team and just a lot of crassness with what they were talking about, the level of collusion with media, with possibly with their super PACs, which is a big no-no.
Right, illegal.
There was that. And the one that really got me was just the level of crassness about the whole issue of democracy, because there was kind of this chiding. Well, somebody said that, there goes our – we no longer have a democracy. Well, no duh was kind of the response.
Oh, gosh. Yikes.
I don't know if that's the exact wording,
right,
but that was the
right.
general gist of it. It's like, what?
Yeah.
So, I mean – the level, tying on top of that, now the Veritas Project, now Rebecca's more familiar with them than I am, but they released some videos over the last few days of Clinton appointee or Clinton people who were kind of working the system, putting pressure on various people. It just, again, this whole level of corruption. And it's kind of funny, too, because And the Sunday school, you're going to talk about your sermon, and I was really challenged by something that happened in our Sunday school where we're studying Isaiah and the level of corruption that was happening
in Isaiah's time.
In Isaiah's time, you know, people who were taking bribes and not standing up for the little people, hearing them big time, and I'm going...
Parallels?
Parallels? Yeah. I mean, we can talk about corruption on both sides of the field. I mean, we can talk about some of the stuff that's happened around Trump, but the stuff that, even though it's harder to get your head around the stuff with Hillary and her people, it's still bad. And God speaks out against both of those.
Right. And really, I think it's just another reminder. I don't think it's going to have a lot of electoral impact personally. I think the people have kind of already decided on what side they're intending to support or on a different side or, you know, make a statement in another way as well. But I do think it behooves us to know what's going on and be informed because that informs our prayers first and foremost. And it also informs our reactions, too, because there is not going – pretty clear, no matter who takes office at any level, really no moral guidance is going to come from the top down. It's not going to come from there. It should come from us.
And neither of those candidates, we would say, are strong on the moral character side of the issue. It does need to come from the church, from the body of Christ. And what an opportunity for us to speak in truth into this election.
Yeah, we talk about the down ballot issues and a lot of people concerned, you know, if their party doesn't show up for the president, that's going to affect the down ballot. I think the challenge on us is, let's find out who these down ballot people are, because if anything is going to change, it really has to come from the bottom up. Mm. And we have to work through the down ballot, everything down from dog catcher up, and really affect change upward.
Well, and, you know, Franklin Graham has challenged all of us. He says, run for school boards, run for city council. Christians need to be involved in the political process. And I think that's a great challenge for all of us. So thanks, Paul and Rebecca. Appreciate your insights.
Thank you, sir. Good morning. It is 19 past the hour here on Faith Radio. I'm Rebecca Maxwell. It is time for Dr. Bill Meyer to respond to your email questions.
Really?
Yes.
Well, good.
Did you know that?
I'm glad you told me.
Surprise.
I'm still waking up here on a Monday morning. Okay.
Yes, now is the time when you get to ask Dr. Bill Meyer about marriage, parenting, other family issues. Bill is able to respond to selected questions on the air, of course, but if he chooses your question, don't worry, he's not going to use your real name. It's okay. We'll protect your anonymity. So feel free to be open and email Dr. Bill. Bill, here's one from a dad that we're going to call Ben. He listens to Faith Radio on our new signal in Madison, 104.7 FM. Ben writes, "Dear Dr. Bill, I have a 6-year-old son. I've heard you talking on the radio about how to teach good financial lessons to kids, and you mentioned something called a 10-10-10-70 budget plan. Can you explain what that is and how it works?"
Yeah, I can, Ben. It's actually pretty simple. Whether you pay your child an allowance or you pay him for a specific chore, you want to have him divide up his earnings in this way. First, he should set aside 10% of his money for a tithe. Okay. You want to explain, the Bible tells us that everything we have actually belongs to God, and that because we love him, we give him the first fruits of our earnings. In the Old Testament days, that meant that the farmer would give the biggest, most delicious fruit from his orchard as an offering at the temple. Then your son should set aside 10% of his money for savings and investment. So you know what you can do? You can take him to a neighborhood bank and you can open a savings account together. Then you might pick up a kid-friendly book on saving and investing, one that explains, for example, how interest compounds over time, because I think a lot of kids don't really understand that. And when you show them the numbers, they can go, wow, my money can earn money just by being in, of course, not as much these days in a bank account, but with an investment, certainly compounding can pay off big time. Now, when he's a little bit older, what you might do is help him open his own brokerage account with an online firm like Fidelity or E-Trade, then help him learn about the various options for investing and why it's so important for him to build what we call a diversified portfolio as he invests his money. Now, the third 10 in that 10-10-10-70 plan should be dedicated to giving. God is clear. We have a responsibility to help the poor. It tells us that in Scripture over and over again, and we should teach our kids that principle from a very early age. What you might do is help your son choose a charity to give his money to. For example, we've been talking a lot about Compassion International during the past month or so, and you might want to contact Compassion, ask them to send you information on sponsoring a needy child in a developing country. Perhaps make this a family project. I've mentioned before our family sponsors three kids in Peru through Compassion, and you might want to do the same in your family. Now, your son could also set aside some of his giving money to needs in his own community, such as maybe a local rescue mission or maybe a family at your church who's having some financial difficulty. And so there are probably a wide variety of ways he could give, and that extra 10% there he can put aside for giving every month. Now, the remaining 70% in that plan that we talked about can be used for spending, but teach him to spend wisely, purchasing items that have lasting value instead of, you know, cheap toys that are going to end up in the trash after a few weeks. That's one lesson our kids have had to learn through the years when, you know, they've seen something that really looks flashy and they really want it, and then 2 weeks later it's busted. Help him learn also, this is another thing really, Ben, you want to do, is help your son learn the concept of delayed gratification, that by not quickly spending his allowance or his chore money on things like candy or cheap toys, he can save it up to buy things he really wants, like a nice baseball mitt or a new bike. And finally, Ben, let me recommend a great book that'll provide you with some, I think, some real good guidance on teaching your kids financial responsibility. It's called Your Kids Can Master Their Money by Ron and Judy Blue and Jeremy White. So thanks for writing, Ben, and I pray that God will grant you wisdom in teaching your kids about saving, investing, and tithing.
Amen. I think we all need wisdom on that score, especially those of us who aren't as skilled with math. thank you so much for your email, Ben. If you have a family-related question that you'd like to ask Dr. Bill, you can write to him at drbill@myfaithradio.com.
I'd love to hear from you. Now, if you're a parent, how much time do your kids spend in front of a screen every day? The American Academy of Pediatrics just came out with some revised guidelines on digital media exposure for kids and teenagers. This past week, the AAP hosted their national conference. About 10,000 pediatricians got together to discuss new children's health recommendations for 2017. And really high on the list, kids' screen time, social media, cyberbullying. They talked about all these things. Now, in the past, the American Academy of Pediatrics has set a general screen time limit. They have said no more than 2 hours in front of the TV for kids over the age of two. But the pediatricians are now saying, in a world surrounded by digital media, defining screen time is a lot more difficult. Dr. Yolanda Reed Crisi, who's an author of this report and a professor at UCLA, says it doesn't make sense to have a blanket statement of 2 hours of screen time anymore, because for some kids, 2 hours may be way too much. So for these new guidelines, the AAP identifies screen time as, get this, time spent using digital media for entertainment purposes. They say that other uses of media, such as doing online homework, don't count. And that makes a lot of sense. The Academy is recommending that for little kids, 2 to 5, screen time should be limited to 1 hour per day. For kids 6 and older, parents can determine what kind of restrictions they want to place on time spent using a screen. Also monitor the types of digital media their kids use. The pediatricians say babies are most vulnerable to screen time. In fact, infants ages 18 months and younger should not be exposed to any type of digital media. And they say, yeah, for parents with infants, cutting off technology might be challenging, but banning screen time for babies is hugely important for brain development and healthy parent-child connections. So some good recommendations from the American Academy of Pediatrics. By the way, if you want to see their full report, you're a mom or dad or a grandma, grandpa, just go to healthychildren.org. That's the parent site for the American Academy of Pediatrics, healthychildren.org. Good morning. 38 past the hour at Faith Radio. We're joined by Dr. Adam Carrington. He's a political science professor at Hillsdale College, one of our regular political analysts here at Faith Radio. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning, Bill. How are you?
Good. We are just 2 weeks away from the presidential election, which I can't even believe. How's the current national polling numbers? How are they shaking out for Clinton and Trump right now?
Right now, it looks, and we haven't had a whole lot of post-third debate polls, but in general, the trend is Clinton with a fairly comfortable lead. Now, when I say that, of course, there are polls everywhere from Clinton up 15 to Trump up 2. But if you take the average of them, it looks like she's up about 6-7 points and comfortably ahead, at least at this point.
Now, are we talking about likely voters, registered voters? Who are the, when we do this polling, who are the folks we're talking about?
Right now, it's predominantly likely voters. In the past, generally, there's about a switch once you get past Labor Day, where polling moves from registered voters to likely voters, because then you start to really get an idea a little bit more of who's actually going to show up. And in fact, one of the polls that showed Clinton out to a massive lead, the Washington Post Daily Tracker that came out yesterday, a lot of it had to do with who they thought were likely voters. They saw a drop in Republican enthusiasm for getting out to the polls and therefore a large jump in Clinton's lead. That's one poll. I would tell people, don't trust one poll, whether it's something that would send you into a panic or something that supports what you'd want to happen. Try to look at the conglomerate of them. What in general is the story being told in the polling rather than one? Otherwise, there will be polls that will be very wrong. I've not been convinced yet that the polling on average is deeply off.
Well, now, one of the things that we've talked about before, that there are some Trump supporters that might not, or people that would vote for Trump, that might not say to a pollster that they would, especially because of what's happened recently. But maybe there are people that are so concerned about Hillary Clinton that they would go ahead and put the clothespin on their nose, so to speak, and vote for Trump, even though they have serious concerns about his character. Is that a possibility?
It's a possibility. I'll just say I've looked into this because I think it sounds on the, it certainly sounds like that could be the case. So far, the there hasn't been a lot of data to support it, at least not in enough to make up a 6 or 7 point lead. And I'll use this: they looked at polling during the primary and found that Trump did not overperform in any dramatic way his polls while the race was still competitive, which meant there wasn't a shy vote in the primaries. Now, as far as the election, the fall election, I'll just say I just don't see a lot of proof yet. In fact, I saw one thing that was sort of comical the other way. They polled a group of men and asked them whether their wives were voting for Hillary Clinton or not, and 33% said their wives were voting for Hillary Clinton. They polled a similar group of women, and 45% of those women said they were voting for Hillary Clinton.
So the guys didn't really know, yeah.
And my wife could tell you that. I'm not saying it couldn't happen. The one piece of information that might make that plausible is that live caller polls where they call you and talk to you, have been friendlier to Clinton, and non-live ones you fill out on the internet, for example, have been friendlier to Trump. That's really the only piece of information I've seen, but I wouldn't hang my hat on it, but I also wouldn't say it's impossible.
What do you make of Trump's warning that, the election is rigged against him and that he will contest the results unless Clinton wins an overwhelming victory?
Well, I'll say that on two levels. One, the media have been making a lot of that and acting as if this is the only time a candidate has questioned the results of the polls. And in some ways, Trump is unique in questioning the results of the polls before they even occur, before the election even occurs. But if you look at 2000, 2004, the Democrats after the election were claiming that, things had gone wrong, that there was, fraud and things like that. That said, as far as electorally, I think this is a very dangerous gamble for Trump, and I think it's one that he might need to take gambles like this. But the reason I say it's dangerous is it could drive his support up. In other words, it could motivate people to say, if the system looks like it's going to be rigged, I'm going to go out and vote to try to fight that. Or there's also, you know, research in the past saying that when candidates at lower levels start talking about polls being rigged or the election being rigged, that some of their supporters tend to stay home.
Mm.
So, you know, as far as an electoral move, I think it's a risky one.
Let's talk about voter fraud in the U.S. Is there any evidence that it has been a widespread occurrence just in recent elections?
I'll say this. There's no doubt that it occurs. But given the way that voter systems are set up, you would tend for it to be massive, widespread, and election changing. You would probably need collusion between both parties. In most states, the vote count goes through several levels of being looked at, and that typically the people looking at those vote totals include Republicans and Democrats, as well as third parties. And they usually occur at the local level, and they occur at a higher up level. So while I think a lot of the voter fraud tends to take place with things like registration, registering people that shouldn't be registered.
Like people that are dead, yeah.
Exactly, people that are dead or people that aren't eligible to vote. You know, there was the instances where, you know, people who aren't legally citizens being allowed to vote. So I guess what I'll say is there's certainly voter fraud that goes on. But again, if Trump loses by more than, you know, a point or two, it would be very difficult to really, you know, substantively show that something like that changed the election.
Mm. Now, those polling place monitors that we hear about from the political parties, what do they actually do on election night? And do they actually have any power to prevent voter fraud right there at the polling places?
Often there are people there, whether monitors or other officials watching, who immediately can call lawyers. And basically, a lot of lawyers are being kept on retainer across the country for election day, election night, and after the election in case these kinds of things happen, so that they can immediately have a cease and desist order or immediately challenge ballots. This is why you see, for example, instances where polling places have malfunctioning equipment or something like that, and you immediately get, if it's a larger Democrat or a larger Republican, you'll immediately get a petition to a local judge from a lawyer for one of the parties saying to keep the polling place open later,
right?
You know, to make up for the time. So yes, there are ways to at least put your challenge in and set up for further legal proceedings if there's a massive irregularity that you can point to.
Mm. Our guest, Dr. Adam Carrington, political science professor at Hillsdale College in Michigan, one of our regular political contributors here at Faith Radio. We will take a quick break and be right back. Good morning, 49 past the hour. It's Faith Radio. Bill Meyer here with Dr. Adam Carrington from Hillsdale College in Michigan. Dr. Carrington is a political science professor there. And Adam, it's been a couple weeks since you and I last spoke. I haven't had a chance to ask you for your thoughts on the third and final presidential debate. As you watch that, you know, comparing it to the first two, how would you rate the two candidates' performance that night?
Actually, I think it was the best debate as far as if you're looking for substance, getting into particular issues, if you're looking for policy details. I think that it was the one that, especially early on, least went off into vagaries and least went off into personal attacks or personality issues, and instead got down to actually asking some questions that I think voters are wanting to do. And I actually think both probably had their best performance. especially for Trump in the first half hour, 40 minutes, and I think even overall, I think both of them did much better. And I think part of that has to do with the moderator. You asked how the two of the candidates did, but Chris Wallace got overwhelming praise for his performance as a moderator, and I think really deserved it and kind of put to shame some of the moderators that had come across in the past. I think he was informed. I think he was disciplined. I think he was, in general, very fair and really held the candidates accountable on both sides.
I was very impressed with him. I've heard a lot of conservatives, a lot of Republicans praise Wallace. Has he received criticism from liberals thinking that he was somehow unfair to Hillary?
There's some, and that's always going to happen, but... cursing with faint praise happened. I'm trying to remember the outlet now. I saw a more left-leaning outlet say that Wallace was really good and how stunned they were.
They don't watch Fox News, right? They don't know who Chris Wallace is.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, but I think that's telling that they had to say it that way, which means that that's a very grudging praise that even sensible people on the left side of the aisle were forced to say that he did a very competent job. And so, yes, of course, there were people that were attacking it. But, I think Wallace seemed to be very aware that he had a Fox News conservative Scarlet F on his chest, and that he needed to try to disprove that without also looking like he was in the can for either candidate. And I thought he did a very good job that forced even people to the left to acknowledge the quality of his performance.
Let's hone in on the discussion about the Supreme Court and what Mrs. Clinton had to say. Did her comments reveal her actual intent when it comes to the type of justices she would appoint, or do you feel she kind of obfuscated on that?
I think you can, especially if you put it together with what she said in the last debate, I think you can definitely put together that by what she said and what she didn't say. And I'll first say what she did say, that, that there really seems like there is going to be a litmus test, and I'm really putting together last debate and this debate, for policy outcomes, that there are certain policy outcomes that she wants that are decidedly to the left, and that she will appoint judges who will accord with what she wants to happen politically. What she didn't say, which is has to be the other half of a positive argument like that, is you never hear her mention the Constitution. you never hear her really mention how she thinks judges should approach interpreting the document that it is one of their primary goals to interpret.
Which Chris Wallace actually asked her. Chris Wallace asked her that question, and she never answered it.
Yep, she. You're exactly right. She completely punted on it. And I think that's very telling for how Clinton and how a large swath of the public, but especially those in the Democratic Party, what they see the role of a judge as and what they see the role of deciding court cases is, and it seems to be entirely out of the perspective or the concept of a judicial power, which is supposed to merely apply the law, not legislate your particular political opinions.
Of course, the outcome of the U.S. Senate races are critical to the future of the Supreme Court and the abortion issue in this country. Just got about 2 minutes left, Adam. At this point, does it appear the Republicans will keep control of the Senate, or is it really up for grabs?
It is very up for grabs. I would have told you maybe 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, that I thought it was tipping in the Republicans' favor. The polling recently has a number of races in, say, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, Nevada, even Missouri, not looking as good, not looking as positive. Some it's a toss-up, some it's leaning in the Democrats' direction. I don't think anything's decided yet, but I think it's very much up for grabs. And what we'll need to see is how well is Trump doing at the top of the ticket, and how well are Trump voters and those who are less decidedly in Trump's camp but still lean Republican, are they going to come together down ballot and up ballot, or is this going to be something where the bottom drops out for the two? And I think it's still not clear which direction that's going to go. Mm.
So we keep our eyes on New Hampshire, Missouri, Pennsylvania, and you said Nevada up for grabs. Now, I was thinking the Republican was significantly ahead there.
He was, but some recent polling has been more mixed. There's been a couple polls where he has been down, and one thing I've been watching is in Nevada, they keep track of early voting, and early voting just started in Nevada, and right now Democrats are outpacing their numbers from 2012, and Republicans are underperforming. Mm. So that's the reason why I think it's an early sign. It's not a definitive sign, but it's something to be concerned about for Joe Heck out there.
You wonder if it's this whole enthusiasm gap. And, you know, I'm sure the pundits will be discussing this for months and years to come, how this election was basically how it may have changed significantly just in the last few weeks, given the accusations against Mr. Trump. So, well, all we can do as Christians is pray. We know that God is indeed in control of our eternal destiny, and that we have to fall back on that. So, Dr. Adam Carrington, thanks so much for your time. We'll look forward to talking to you again real soon.
I look forward to it, Bill. Thank you.